This will be an introduction to what kind of languages you can run on .NET and how they're implemented on it. So, why would you be interested in looking at dynamic languages? You got C Sharp, you got Java already, it's cool. Why do you want to look at this new weirdo thing? One thing that's up is that it's pretty trendy. There's a lot of cool guys in the community that's talking about dynamic languages, especially a language like Ruby. There's also a trend towards more functional, concurrent languages, languages that are different, that have a different paradigm behind them, because there's an idea that this would makes it easier for us to express the problems we have and thereby make better solutions. You might want to be famous. There's some pretty cool famous guys that are using dynamic languages. I don't know if they were famous before they started using dynamic languages or the dynamic languages made them famous. It's probably the first. But there are guys like Uncle Bob, who's a proponent of Ruby. There's a guy like Martin Fowler, who's here at the conference too, who also speaks very highly of Ruby. There's the Danish guy, David Heinemeier Hansen, who made the Rails application framework, which is kind of popular. You might want to lose some weight. There's an idea that dynamic languages are typically more expressive, and they're less verbose than their static brethren, meaning you don't usually put in types, and losing all the types you need to declare everything with kind of loses weight. So it's easier to express yourself, would be the opinion. Maybe you're just interested in it and want to see what's the new kid on the block like. What is this thing? Is it something that I want to work at? And maybe you want to make a lot of money. I can't promise the last thing, but some people have definitely made money off of using dynamic languages. So what makes a language dynamic? So before I get too much into the whole what is a dynamic language and how does it differ from other languages, I want to say that a lot of the stuff I'm going to say today is probably going to be be a caricature of how dynamic languages are perceived. I do that not to talk down static languages or dynamic languages for that sake, but more to make a point. So I might say things that are kind of provocative, and you're welcome to call me out, but I do it mainly to sort of illustrate the differences. So what makes language dynamic? Well, there's of course the definition from Wikipedia, which is where we all go when we need to figure out what's up and what's down in a thing. And usually it comes down to when things are evaluated. So in a dynamic language, you typically evaluate things as late as possible, so you wait till runtime to evaluate things. Whereas in a static language, you typically evaluate as much as you can up front. That means at compile time. And usually that's what it all boils down to. What's interesting about that, of course, is that the stuff that you do at runtime means that, well, you can change it. Because if you don't make the decision until runtime, that means you can actually change it at runtime, which makes for some pretty interesting use cases. So what are some of the characteristics of these types of languages? Well, one would be duck typing. And the idea behind this is the duck test, meaning if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. The reason behind this is that instead of having a specific interface up front that you use to say this is an IEnumerable or something like that, which means I have these specific methods I can call on it, this is my contract. Instead, you don't really care about that. All you care about is, does this object reply to the message I'm sending it? So if you have a duck that knows how to bark, it's fine, you don't care. All you're interested in is that it responds to that message. That's sort of duck typing. What that means is it's more of a loose type of coupling, whereas in static languages we have a very tight like contract between our things. There's a tight contract between the caller and the callee, meaning we have a specific object, we call a method on it, we know it exists up front. You don't necessarily know this in a dynamic type language because you resolve it at runtime. It's late bound. Those of you who've done VB in a past life, I'm sure some have, we all have, and we're still recovering, we'll have, you know, there's a very strict sense of late boundness in VB. Another thing is functions. We've seen this in C# lately in the last couple of versions. There's been more functional programming added to the language, meaning functions are treated as first-class citizens, meaning that you can actually talk about a function being a concept that you can pass around. So like you have in an object-oriented language, you have objects, and those objects you can pass around. You as well can get a reference to a function, and that function you can pass around. It's like a delegate. But usually in a dynamic type language, functions would be something that's at the forefront of what you're doing. Metaprogramming is another thing that's... It would probably be the thing that differs the most from a typical static language. Metaprogramming is, well, programming about programming. So the idea is that as you're programming in your language, you're also extending the language. There's an idea about looking at your code as data and your data as code. And once you can go from having code expressed as data, you can manipulate it as data. And then afterwards, you can convert it back into code. That's one way of thinking of it. Another way of thinking of it is that you can take your language and you can mold it into whatever kind of domain you're working with. That's what happens in a web framework like Rails. They're taking the Ruby programming language and its metaprogramming features, and they're molding them into a domain of doing web application development, which means as you're working with the language, you get certain types of idioms and certain types of concepts of web application development incorporated into the language. And because the language is very open to extension and addition of methods or whatever other thing you would want to do, and it's very orthogonal, meaning that you can compose the same types of language constructs in the language yourself as the language developer did. Because you can do this, you can mold the language into whatever domain you're working with, a domain-specific language. It's cool, but tricky. There's also typically a notion of high degree of runtime introspection. So that would be like doing reflection on .NET. But it's usually more easily accessible, and it's usually more easy to munch around in all this stuff. Again, it's a sharp line, like, because you can do a lot of cool stuff with reflection in .NET today, but typically you'd have some deeper capabilities in a dynamic type language. So why do we want to continue looking at these dynamic languages? Well, there's a simplicity to it. Some users believe that dynamic code can be easier to comprehend and easier to express than that code written in a static type language. It's usually more expressive, it's more terse, meaning you can write more one-liners. But those of you who've done Perl know that that's not necessarily a good thing. But you can do it, and it's typically more easy for you to express yourself in a more elegant way that suits yourself to the domain. It's sort of when people went from C#, one to the features you got with Link. Suddenly you have a way of looking at collections, iterating over them, that's much more fluent. You get a much more fluent experience with it, and it's much easier for you to express yourself in a specific way. And this is obviously the thing about perspective. It's a good thing to figure out what's going on the other side of the fence. I mean, it's a good thing to figure out, is there a better way to do the work I'm doing today? It's a matter of having enough tools in your toolbox that enables you to pick the right tool. Like the classic saying that if all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. It's exactly the same thing with this. There's the whole notion about being a polyglot programmer, meaning that you can talk in different languages, you can work in different languages, and you choose the language that's specific to your domain. That's a very interesting reason and a good enough reason for actually doing these things. Like for a couple of years, the pragmatic programmers have been saying you ought to teach yourself a new language every year. And the reason for that is exactly because you want to put perspective into what you're doing. You want to figure out, am I doing the things in the right way? And that's all very fine and well, and why are these hippies rock around and tell us that we should do different stuff? We're already running static languages and it's fine. And yeah, some of it is a bit hippie-like. But there's a certain certain element of that's kind of interesting in itself too, because it is a different way of looking at things. So now I've talked a bit about how cool dynamic languages is, and it's the best thing since sliced bread. There's obviously bad things to it as well. Some of the things you typically hear about the dynamic language is that it's slow. That's great. All the stuff you do at runtime, I do at compile time. So obviously you're slower. And yeah, you are. What you're doing is you're basically trading slowness at runtime for being more productive and being more efficient when you're actually developing it. That's the reasoning behind it. At least that's what they say. The other thing you'd say is that dynamic languages, code written in dynamic languages has more bugs. I have a type system in my static compiler. It helps me. It catches all the stupid ass bugs I do. Oops. Proponents of dynamic languages would say, yeah, but I do a lot more unit testing, so it doesn't really matter much. My unit tests sort of catches the errors I make. And besides, like, type errors is just one class of errors. They don't cover like logical errors. There's also a matter about tools. Typically, there would be better tools in static languages. Because of the type system and because of the way the compiler works, it makes all the decisions up front, means you can take out all this information, you can process it, and you can make really cool intelligence, for example. That's difficult in a dynamic languages. People try, people have done, like have made effort towards making these sort of things, and there is some rudimentary intelligence support today, but it's not, you know, nearly as good as in a static language. And it's difficult. Like, you have less tool support in general over dynamic type languages, so stuff as refactoring. People addicted to ReSharper will have a hard time necessarily jumping to a dynamic type language. So what this all adds up to is that we're sort of in two pillars. We have the dynamic language part on one side, and we have the static languages on the other part. And the good things and the bad things are sort of counter. So a dynamic language would typically be simple and succinct. It's implicitly typed. You don't put in your types. It figures it out by itself. You have a lot of metaprogramming. You mold the language as you go. There's no compilation. Everything's interpreted, and everything is done at runtime. Again, a big caricature. Static languages are typically perceived as being more robust, more performant. You have a bunch of intelligent tools to help you out doing your coding, and it scales better. That would at least be the argument. And again, like, bottom line, the difference between static language, dynamic languages is when they do stuff. Dynamic languages do it at runtime, make decisions at runtime. Static languages do it at compile time beforehand. Cool. So what does this matter to .NET? So there's a guy called Jim Hugenin who a while ago, years ago, made this thing called Jiten, which was an implementation of Python running on the JVM. And at that time, there's a lot of talk about this new thing called .NET, and there was this thing called the CLR, and it was kind of interesting. And there was a lot of talk about it. What was also a lot of talk about was the fact that the CLR sucked for dynamic languages, meaning that there was an idea of the CLR just... It's not fit for dynamic languages. It's made specifically for statically typed languages, and that's just the way it is. So that's cool. So this guy, Jim Hugenin, thought, that's great. I just made a Jython implementation running on the JVM. I'm going to do the same thing on the CLR, and I'm going to publish a paper saying how Microsoft screwed up that a CLR sucks for dynamic languages. Cool. So he did that. The only problem with it was that he found out that it wasn't really that bad. It actually worked pretty well. And so that became Iron Python. Later, he got hired by Microsoft, Jim Hugenin, to work on Iron Python because I guess it was kind of cool having a dynamic language in your stables. And he continued working on that, and they got a version 2.0 out. And from the stuff that they had, from the experience they've made from implementing a dynamic language on top of the CLR, they extracted a base layer, like the basic things you need in order to implement a dynamic language on top of the CLR. That thing is called a dynamic language runtime. So this thing sort of came about from an actual implementation project, which makes it interesting in a number of ways, one of which, of course, is that it's already proven itself. It was taken from something that works instead of being an academic exercise in how to make this stuff run. The DLR sits on top of the CLR. The CLR is the JVM on .NET, but since you're all .NET developers, I'm sure you know how that stuff works out. But basically what it does is it's a library that sits on top of the common language runtime. And what happens is that you implement your own languages, your own dynamically typed languages, using the features in the DLR, and you sort of put them on top. And then using that, you have our static normal languages like C#, VB.NET. We have them already. And they just sort of interact via this bus of the DLR. How that works is, let's say we have the dynamic language runtime in the middle. What happens is we have some Iron Python code that want to do some member access. They want to call a member on X. We want to call x.foo. What happens is that call gets into the DLR, and by calling some specific APIs in it, it says, this thing that's called X, does it have a member named foo? And for Python, we ignore case. We're case insensitive. So we obviously say, we ignore the case. That gets translated into a call into a binder. It's a DLR concept. And the binder is what knows how to translate things from one world to another. So in this case, X was an Iron Python object, which means we use the Python binder to look up the member. It could have been a .NET object, in which case we would have used the .NET binder. And it could have been any other type of binder, like a COM binder if we use Office. It could have been that the language was Ruby instead. It could have been, then of course we would have the Ruby binder. It could have been C#. It could have been VB.NET. It could have been whatever. And this mechanism is exactly the same that's going on if you use the dynamic keyword in C# that was introduced in C# 4.0. When you declare something dynamic, what you're really doing underneath is that you're hooking yourself up to an object that's inside of the DLR. The DLR knows how to dispatch all of these things. That's how it does all the Office mumbo-jumbo things, so we lose the system.missing property. So what does that mean to the big controversy I had up before? Well, it means that instead of having two separate worlds that can't exist, we all of a sudden get a world where everything sort of works together. That's at least the idea. So we can pick the language that we think is most appropriate for the job we have. And we can still interact with all the stuff that we know beforehand because it's all .NET underneath. And then we can all live in peace, to stay in our hippie metaphor. The Iron language is a first-class .NET citizen, so it's not like they're anything less than anything else. The two languages that Microsoft produces, although that is something I'm going to get back to at the end of the slideshow, but the two languages that Microsoft backs, at least that's the way it is now, are called Iron Ruby and Iron Python. And there are like a full implementation of those languages running on the DLR and thereby running on .NET. It's also integrated with Silverlight, so you can use these languages when you do your Silverlight development. So what does Iron mean? Well, besides being cool, Iron, that is, the idea of these languages is that they want to make sure that they have a high fidelity to what's the real language experience. It means we want to be true to the language. They're not making some kind of a fork, like managed JScript or anything other weird-ass stuff that came out. They want to be true to the community. They want to involve the community into the process of building all of these languages. They want to be true to the experience, meaning they want to have the exact same things available, meaning when you download Python off the original distribution, you get a specific set of EXEs that you can use to do your work, kind of the compiler or the interpreter. That means that when you do IronPython, you obviously need to get the exact same things, because these skills you have in one domain needs to be transferable to another. And of course, it needs to have excellent performance. That's why people would want to put it on .NET. And it obviously needs a really good integration with .NET, meaning that it should be easy to integrate into the .NET libraries. It should be easy to integrate into other languages. This is where the dynamic keyword in C# comes in. It should be easy to use in .NET hosts, meaning it should be very easy to take this language, host it in your own application, and use it. And it should be very easy to use with the .NET tools you know already. Being that acronyms is a big thing in IT, some wisecracker thought that Iron might meet implementation running on .NET. I don't think that's true. I think it's a thing that came after the fact, but either way, it's kind of, it's at least interesting. Then you can say it has a, there's some kind of reason behind it. What's also interesting about it, and this is particularly interesting, I think, is that the code for Iron Ruby and for Iron Python is open source. It used to be released under the Microsoft public license, which is an OSI ratified license, meaning that yes, it is technically open source, but it's not open source in the sense that what most people would think is open source. You can download all the text and source code and you can do whatever you want with it, basically. Recently, the whole DLR, Iron Ruby, and Iron Python was relicensed under the Apache license. I'm not entirely sure why. I believe it has something to do with feedback they got back from the community, meaning that it's easier to integrate the Apache license into other projects than it is to integrate stuff running under the Microsoft public license. I think that's what it, or permissive license, MSPL, whatever, doesn't matter. It's now the Apache license. But what's really interesting about this is that it sort of marks a shift for Microsoft. Because Microsoft and open source is not a thing you'd be able to say in the same sentence, at least not 5 years ago. Iron Ruby actually today takes in contributions from open source developers. The idea is that Iron Python will do the same at some point in time, but they haven't gotten to it yet. So it sort of marks a shift for Microsoft. And that perspective, I think it's very interesting. Now, there are other languages running on the DLR than just the Microsoft ones. There's a JavaScript implementation called IronJS, made by a Norwegian guy. It's actually pretty cool. He just published some new benchmarks the other day, and he's doing pretty good compared to V8, the Google engine, and also IE9, so that's very interesting. There's an implementation of Clojure running on the DLR as well, utilizing the DLR. And there's maybe or maybe not an implementation of Iron Scheme. They were going to use the DLR to implement it, but I don't really know what that project is now. But at some point in time, they did use the DLR. So it all sort of underplays the fact that the DLR is a generic platform for making these dynamic languages. It's not just a specific thing for either Iron Python or Iron Ruby. So why would you want to look at these languages? Well, there's sort of three main reasons, and you can obviously think of your own, but one would be that they're very easy to extend. So typically, Iron Ruby, or typically Python and Ruby developers, if they needed more performance, they would have to implement an extension in C, and you'd have to figure out all the pointers, and there's a lot of other stuff going on. You need to do your own garbage collection, reference counting, or whatever. It's kind of difficult, and it takes up a lot of code. Using this, it's very easy to extend the language in C# and get some of the same performance benefits you'd do by implementing it in C compared to Python. They're very easy to embed, so it's very easy for you to embed one of these runtimes in your own application and thereby make a scripting language for your own application. And of course, they're very easy to do .NET interop, so if you want to do some kind of quick shell script or batch script or whatever, it's very easy to do, and it's very easy to explore .NET libraries using Iron Ruby or Iron Python. I'm going to show three demos today. One would be a test framework that shows how to do the .NET interop. There'll be some stuff about how to extend your own application as well, so you can utilize Python code or Ruby from your own application. So I think I've talked plenty about slides now, so we're going to move into the code. The first thing I'm going to show you is a testing framework written in Iron Ruby. And what we're going to do is we're basically going to emulate this thing. That would be your typical unit test written in XUnit. This is MS test. But it sort of looks the same if it's NUnit or whatever other unit, right? We've got our attributes that we mark on our class saying this includes a class. And then for each of the methods inside, we mark it with a test method and we say this is a test. And we do our asserts on whatever we want to do. This tests the built-in stack implementation of .NET. So it's not like it's really interesting, but it's interesting in the sense that it serves to illustrate some of the things you can do. So I'm going to see if this thing works. So this is basically the exact same thing as what I showed just before in C#. What's interesting about this, if we sort of look besides the first four lines, is that it reads a lot like English. Instead of the thing we had before where we were saying assert dot equals X is something else, it's kind of Yoda speak. This is more fluent. You know, describe a set of .NET stack operations. Do this. It should create an instance with zero elements. Do this. Stack.new.count should be zero. So whenever we create a new stack, the count should be zero. Makes sense. When we run this, we have some other pretty cool options too. Can you guys see all this? Okay. Meaning that this stuff we had just before that was in code that sort of read out aloud like English, we can print out all this stuff to the console as well. So we sort of get a nice spec of what our code is supposed to do. So how's this implemented? Well, basically what's going on behind this, behind the scenes, is that describe is a method call. And a feature of Ruby is that you don't need to use parentheses. It sort of fidgets it out for itself if it's necessary or not. So this is a method call, describe. It takes a string, which is the description of what we're going to do. And then it also takes this funny thing called do. And at the end, we have an end. So what's going on is really that we're inside of this method call, we're sending a string, and we're sending whatever is inside, is between the do and the end, which in this case is a block. So that's a code block, a block of code. It's a delegate. The second method call we have down here is it. That's a method call too. It does exactly the same thing. It takes a string as a parameter, and it takes a block. The block is the code. The block is the asserts. And then there's the final thing, which is this method. So you'd expect that count would return an integer of some type. And it would be weird if the integer implementation in Ruby had a method called should. So obviously something funny is going on here. And I'll show what that is in a bit. So how is this implemented? So down here we see the exact same thing I was showing before. So we have the describe method first. So that's how we would define a method in Ruby. What it does is that it has the identifier, which would be describe, and then it takes the string description. Then we do some stuff inside. We print it out. That doesn't matter much. Then we do this thing called yield. What's going on is that every method call in Ruby can take an anonymous block, and that anonymous block is sort of passed, like it's just sort of there. That's part of the magic of Ruby. And whatever happens is that whenever we yield inside of a method, we give control to the method that came in anonymously, the block of code that was between the do and the end and describe. So whatever code is inside of that gets executed, and we continue. And then when it's done, it will call back to us, and we'll write out end. Same thing goes on with the it method, exactly the same thing. It gets an anonymous block. We yield to that block, and it executes whatever's inside of it. Then we get down to the should. And this is an example of the metaprogramming features of Ruby. Because what happens here is that we're opening up the class object, and everything in Ruby inherits from object. So we're opening up this definition again, and then we're monkey patching. That's the term of it. We're monkey patching. We're hatching on a new method to this object, or anything that inherits from object, which is anything in Ruby. So every object gets it. So we add on a new method called should. Whatever happens inside of should is that it returns a new object of positive expectation with itself. And positive exception, all it does is that it does an initialization, saves the self-reference inside of itself, and then whenever you call equals equals on it, operator overloading, standard practice, whenever you call equal equal on it, you just compare it to whatever you got in. And that's it. At the end, we print out the messages we sort of saved during the execution. So that's just sort of a hook for being able to do stuff at exit. And all of that, what that amounts to is the exact same thing. Of course, if I changed my stack thing and instead said, it should be one, it'll point out there was an error in the first test, and at the bottom we'll see all the failures saying that I wanted zero but I got one. That's Ruby in 5 minutes or something like that. So the other thing, I was going to go back to the slides, but I don't think I'm going to. I think I'm just going to continue doing the demo thing. I just had a brief demo slide anyway. So the other thing that's kind of cool that got in lately is IronPython tools for Visual Studio. Previously, it was an issue that there was no sort of official IDE experience for any of these languages that Microsoft makes inside of Visual Studio. There's a lot of reasons for why that would be unfortunate. One of it would be because of adoption. There are shops out there who won't use anything if it's not coming out of Redmond. And also the whole file new project, if you can't find it as a new project, it doesn't exist, you won't use it. So for adoption reasons, it's been sort of missing. And it also ties in with the fact that the most voted item on Microsoft's feature request board called Connect has been an IDE for IronPython, like an integration of this language inside of Visual Studio, the IDE that people like to use. So, at PyCon, the Python conference recently, they released something. And this is a newer version of it that was released with IronPython 2.7 alpha. So you can just download this today. What I'm using here is a Python library called Beautiful Soup that you can use to read in a web page, and then you can do all kinds of magic with it. So you can print it out, or you can select tags from it. It's sort of like an HTML prettifier with more stuff. The reason I picked this is just that, well, it's Python code, and there's a lot of it, so it's a good case for showing this. So we can do the typical things that we would expect from using Visual Studio. So if I go to down here, I can do a Shift F12, and that would give me find all references. So it knows how to look into the code that I'm currently looking at and sort of analyzes it and figures out what kind of method calls are there and how can I navigate between them. It's pretty cool. We can go to this specific reference, for example, and then we can hover over these method calls and we can see the types of variations that these methods deal with. Because as we're talking about previously, the problem with these dynamic languages is that there's no like method definition saying, I take a collection of strings, or I take an integer. So it sort of needs to figure out what is this thing going on. Like when it executes it, it knows what it is, because if you put in zero in a variable, it knows that there's a zero in the variable. But it doesn't necessarily know this when you're doing it, when you're not executing it. So what they've implemented is some kind of analyzer that runs through all the code and figures out all the permutations of whatever you can stick to it and how you use it, and then they'll make out this documentation and intelligence. So we can see in this case that it would take either just objects or tag objects or beautiful soup objects. And in either case, it would return a result set of instance. An instance of result set, sorry. What also works, which is typically very difficult to do, is IntelliSense. So in this case, it would know what fix is. Meaning it would know that it's a regular expression pattern. And then it would give me all the methods that are allowed in this case. The underscore underscore are like internal hooks inside of Python that they use for different stuff. But in this case, you know, we can do substitution, or we could do splits, or we could do, you know, a bunch of different things. So having IntelliSense in your dynamic language is it's kind of cool. And it's kind of difficult to implement, which is why it's kind of cool to show off. Okay, let's try and run this thing. I'll delete this fakey code. Yep. So what I'm doing here is that I just declared a string that has some kind of dummy HTML in it. I could go outline and I could type in google.com and it would just go out and scrape all that stuff down and analyze it, but I chose the easy path to not upstir the demo gods, and so I typed in the HTML code myself. So we're just creating a new beautiful soup object out of this string that I declared up here, and I just declared a breakpoint, and of course now it breaks. Which means I can go in and I can sort of start to investigate this thing. I can step over this thing and I would see that it would have prettified the HTML I put in. So we just print that out to the console. I can of course also drag the current what's going on pointer around and I can step into this function call instead. I can step over and I can step in and I can sort of navigate through the code. That's pretty cool. Because if you've used dynamic languages previously and you do it directly from the console using Emacs or whatever other thing you're doing, it's kind of difficult doing these things. This is the type of things that we're used to when we're doing C#, because we've always had it and it's always been there. But tools like this doesn't really exist. There are a few out there and people have put in a lot of effort into making these, but traditionally they don't exist. And the last thing is also that we can, of course, do the interactive window, so we can put all of this stuff into a sort of REPL, a read, eval, print loop down here, meaning that I take all the code that I have up in this window and I sort of execute it in an internal Python, Iron Python instance that I have down here. So we can see what goes on is that it's exactly the same thing that I had in my console. It also means that I have access to the exactly same thing, same variables I had before. So I can write soup down here, and I can get IntelliSense, and I can sort of navigate around my code, and the code that I'm working on right now. So it gives you a lot of power in developing your new applications. And what it also does is, of course, it gives you the file new project thing. So everybody's happy. So clear the road for adoption. Okay, final thing, let's extend our applications using a scripting language. So, I haven't made this thing, it's a sample, but it conveys my exact skills in making UI. So what this is bad paint. So it's a very simple application for making very interesting squares and coloring them, or triangles, or whatever other stuff you want to do. So please imagine a very cool program that does a lot of cool stuff. And apparently I can't even use the triangle, never mind. So what does this application do? Well, what it does is that it has the Iron Python and Iron Ruby languages embedded inside of them, meaning I can execute code. So if I select this square up here and give it a name down here called A, for example. Then I have an option to choose what kind of language I want to evaluate now. And I got a big text box, meaning I can put in code. So basically what happens is that I expose this type of canvas inside of the environment I'm going to run IronPython in. I'm going to show the code for doing that in a bit. And I just sort of give access to the entire object model and let it manipulate it. So if I run this code, it changes the width. Wow. So how do we do this? What happens is, this is my the code for the bad paint, the code behind for the SAML. What happens up here at line 32 is that we're instantiating a new script runtime. A script runtime is the thing that knows how to evaluate code. It's the thing that is, in fact, the DLR. We create it from the configuration file. So if we go to the configuration file, we'll see that I got a couple of languages defined in here. I got IronPython defined, and I got IronRuby defined. And if I had made my own language called Christian's pretty cool dynamic language, I could put it in here, and I would be able to write code that extends bad paint in Christian's pretty cool language. So if we go back, we'll see that I create a script scope down here. A script scope is whatever scope you're executing the code in. Then I set a global variable called application. That was the one we used just before. The application gives access to this, and this, in this case, is the main window of my SAML file. So it's the GUI, it's the thing, and I can navigate the object model as I could do in C# or whatever. I load a couple of assemblies in, so I have access to brushes and the canvas and do whatever stuff I want. And then when I click update click, that was the run code button, what it does is that it looks at my... It takes the current language that's selected, that was what we got from the combo box. And we retrieve that language from the DLR, and we say this is the type of thing we want to execute right now. Taking that language, we create an engine that we can run this code in, and then we just execute what's inside of the text box, inside of the engine, and it does whatever it wants. And that's it. It's all it takes to extend your application with the language from the DLR. Now, then we can also do some other cool stuff. So this, So this is the same application as before, it just has a bit more cool stuff in it. And now I'm going to copy paste some code in here too, because I'm not going to write it all. So of course we can do stuff that's a bit more advanced, like that. Because all it really does is that it gives us access to the canvas and we can do whatever we want. So if we can do weird loops with randomizing stuff in Python code down here, well, we can, of course, draw this. What we can also do would be do this. Okay. So I make a circle, that's nice. But the cool thing is this. Now this is Ruby code. So what I just executed before was IronPython code. That made the circle. The code I have down here is IronRuby code. I'm going to execute that too. So what happens is obviously the thing is going around. That's not really the interesting part. What happens first, we can mix and match the languages. We can use Python code and we can use Ruby code and they can manipulate the exact same things. Because what's going on in the background is it's all running on top of .NET using the exact same objects and the exact same object model. What's also going on is, of course, that the thing is going around. And that's not because it's Ruby that it goes around, that it just has a magic way of doing that. What happens is, of course, that the code I have in here is doing some stuff. And my runtime that I host inside of Bad Paint is, of course, doing stuff as well. So if I close this down, I'm going to show you how this is made. We have a timer set up here. So it's a regular timer, there's nothing fancy, the rest of the code is exactly the same. I'm only going to show the differences. So we have a timer set up. Whenever we click update click, down here, you see there's a couple of more lines. Now the stuff to line 69 was what we saw just before, but what happens down here is that we declare a new delegate, a delegate called callback action, and it has the type of action. So once we've executed the code, we take the scope, the script scope that we just executed the text inside of. We take that and we say, hey, do you have a thing called callback? That's the try-get variable. That's what that does. And if it does, it means that the callback, we get that out into the callback action. That's what happens over here. We declare an out variable over here. So if you have something called callback, well, just give it to me. Give me a reference. We save that reference inside a callback down here, and that's it. So what do we use callback? Well, we use it down here. So whenever our timer elapses, whenever the timer's up, it's set to 30 times per second. Whenever that happens, we say, you know what, run this method called run callbacks. That's what happens over here. When we just dispatch it using the regular WPF dispatcher mechanism so we don't get into trouble with threats. So we run this method called run callbacks. And all it does is it checks, well, is the callback thing set? Well, if it is, we call it. And that's it. And that's what's enabled us to make the thing go around. So using this, we've mixed and matched like two different types of dynamic languages. And we've utilized it from the runtime, from the host. So it makes for some pretty interesting use cases for extending your own applications and building in these types of scripting languages. Because you don't have to make your own language and you don't have to do the whole implementation. You can just piggyback on somebody else's work. Okay. Well, let me see if this thing works. Yeah. No. Okay, great. So we saw the IronPython tools, and the slides will be available on the conference website, of course. I'm going to put them up on my blog as well, so you can get all the URLs and whatever. We saw BadPaint. That was a way to extend our own application with scripting language capabilities. And so what's up with the future? So I sort of hinted at it just before. There's apparently been a change in prioritization inside of Microsoft. Woohoo, that's a new thing. And that means that a lot of the people that worked on these languages left. Some moved into another part of the organization, some like left entirely. So there's a bit of a confusion about what's going to happen in the future. IronRuby 1.1 came out recently in July with the .NET 4.0 release. IronPython 2.7 Alpha was just released. So people are still working on it, but there's not a designated team as there was before. They're talking about what's going to happen now. Are they going to donate the code to a thing like the Apache Foundation, which would tie well in with the whole relicensing things into the Apache license? Will they donate it to the CodePlex Foundation, the new foundation that Microsoft made that should support open source projects? And nobody really knows. What's interesting about it is that the DLR has two parts. It has the inner parts and the outer parts. The inner part ships with the .NET framework, meaning they're not going away. And they carry the exact same supportability things you get when Microsoft ships stuff. IronRuby, IronPython is implemented on top of that in their open source stuff, so they don't carry the same supportability. So nobody really knows what's going on in the future, but there's definitely a lot of discussions about what's going to happen. So that's the only sort of, kind of icky. Other than that, it looks pretty good. So what's in it for you? Well, go check it out. Like, figure out if dynamic language is something you want to use. If you're a .NET developer today, as most of you in here are, you know, try and check some of this stuff out. You already know the .NET skills. You have all the knowledge of the libraries. It's just a new syntax, and you can utilize whatever you know beforehand. The single Ruby or Python guy in here can then use it to check out .NET instead. Try to make your own application. Try to extend your application with one of these languages as a scripting language. Try to utilize the dynamic keyword and this sort of interplay between the dynamic world and the static world. Make your own language. Like if you've got a compiler guy sitting inside of you that's just screaming to get out there and make your own very, very cool, extremely dynamic language, go ahead and try it. It's easy. A couple of URLs for where to pick stuff up, and that's about it. So. So I don't have anything else. If you guys have any questions, we can do this now, or you can come down and we can talk about it, or you can run out and skip ahead of the queue for the lunch. I mean, you're welcome to do whatever you want. And please, when you leave, please leave an email note so I can figure out if I sucked or if it rocked. Thanks. Any questions? Cool, thanks.